So now I want to welcome Gary Burdick. He's a professor of physics at Andrews University.
Thank you. So today I want to go back about 400 years prior to our previous presentation and talk about the philosophical and theological foundations of modern empirical science. So what I want to talk about is some of the foundations that we take as self-evident principles today that weren't always quite so self-evident. So just quickly, what are these principles I'm talking about? The first is that the universe exists and warrants study. This may seem self-evident to us today, but to the ancient Greeks, the physical universe wasn't important. The real universe was the universe of the mind, the universe of thoughts. And so you didn't need to study physical reality. But then we come to the question of why is there something rather than nothing? Or what is it that causes the universe to go to all the bother of existing? Science doesn't really tell us that. But science does believe that the universe exists and warrants study. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing science because we have to have something to study. The second assumption is really just as self-evident to us today, which is it's orderly and follows mathematical laws. Again, we take this as axiomatic today, but just looking back through history, it wasn't. If you think of ancient Chinese, they had great technology, they didn't have science. Because they felt the universe was basically irreducibly complex, there was no point in trying to find simplified laws because the universe was complex, and so they developed technology, but never developed anything like what we call natural laws. The third assumption is that we are actually capable of understanding the universe. Again, we can't do science if we don't think that we're actually capable of understanding the laws that put together the universe. Albert Einstein, his actual quote is, "The eternal mystery of the world is its comprehensibility. The fact that it's comprehensible is a miracle." That's not the way it's typically quoted. Most people hear that quote now as the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. Why is it that we think that we are capable of understanding how the universe is put together? Well, if we didn't think that, we wouldn't do science. So these three assumptions, none of which can be shown to be true by science, must be accepted in order to do science. Now, if we look at this as Christians, we look at these three assumptions and say, this is simply arising from the doctrine of creation. The universe exists, it follows mathematical laws, it's worthy of study because God is its creator. And we are capable of understanding the universe because we are created in God's image. God created us to understand what he did after him. So the question is this just fortuitous circumstance? That somehow these principles that as Christians we take as foundational principles of creation are hardwired into the science? Or is this something that is actually legitimate in the history of science that came about this way? And historians of science now believe that it's the latter. The fact is that the founders of modern empirical science were uniformly all religious. So I just put a few quotes up here from various scientists in the late 16th, early 17th centuries. It was the Christians who believed that there was order in nature. It was the Christians who believed that we could understand that order. As I put on the front, the quote by C.S. Lewis, men became scientific because they expected law in nature. And they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. So all modern secular science is based on these fundamental assumptions. Anyone who is doing science is using these assumptions. And if you use these assumptions, you will agree on the data. In my personal research in lanthanide spectroscopy, my primary research collaborators are Presbyterian, Hindu, Buddhist, and atheist. And I assure you, we have never disagreed on what the mean of our data is. And that's really the essence of what we call secular science. The fact is that independent of our worldview, we accept these fundamental assumptions, and therefore we agree on the results. So everyone, no matter what their worldview or religion, follows these same self-evident principles of interpretation, and that's how science moves forward. Now, this is true of ordinary or regular science. You mentioned Thomas Kuhn. Thomas Kuhn talked about the work done within the scientific paradigm, the regular normal science, but he also talked about extraordinary or revolutionary science. Most of us spend our entire lives doing regular science, and our publications and our books and papers and presentations are all done within this regular science realm. But there's a few who typically are the ones that make it into the textbooks, the Galileos and the Keplers and the Newtons and the Maxwells and the Einsteins, who are doing revolutionary science. And my claim is that when you are doing this revolutionary science, the revolution comes from outside of science itself. And so therefore, when you have this revolution, the worldview understanding of the person tends to have a very important impact on their science. And so this is what I want to talk about today, is three of these revolutionary scientists: Johannes Kepler, Isaac Newton, and James Clerk Maxwell. And it turns out that to understand these individuals, you have to understand their worldviews. But in order to understand their science truly and completely, you have to understand their worldviews. You can't just separate their science from their worldview when you're talking about these revolutions. So first off, Johannes Kepler. Johannes Kepler was, as far as I can tell, the first of the scientists to explicitly write about these three fundamental assumptions. And he did so explicitly within his context of his belief in creation. I'm drawing on Melissa Kane Travis's recent biography of Kepler, and a quote from her: "Kepler's life work was driven by the theological belief that the rational plan of creation, pre-existent in the mind of God, is stamped upon the world in a way that makes it accessible to the mind of man, a creature made in God's image." So Travis sees three primary theological principles in Kepler's science. One, the physical world is God's creation, grounded in the mind of God. Two, the order of the world is based upon mathematical laws that existed in the mind of God prior to creation. And three, human rationality that is able to understand the physical world and the mathematical laws upon which it's based comes from God. That is, we are creatures made in the image of God. So Kepler was the first to apply mechanical physics to describe the motion of the heavens. Always before Aristotle and on, you had the four elements here. You had the quintessence, the fifth element. You didn't describe the heavenly motion in the same terms that you described the earthly motion. But Kepler sought to do this, and his success came not in spite of his theology, but to a large degree because of his theology. Kepler sought to understand the creator through nature and believed that the natural philosopher is the priest in God's cosmic temple, worshiping and glorifying God by exegeting the book of nature. His deepest conviction was that his work in astronomy was a kind of communion that yielded dazzling glimpses into the very mind of God. This work of Kepler was built upon by Newton and others after him, but these three fundamental assumptions have remained foundational to modern empirical science. So after Kepler came Isaac Newton. Now, I will say that up to about 20 years ago, biographers of Isaac Newton presented Newton as a great mathematician and a great physicist, and either ignored everything else about Isaac Newton or said, well, we know he did these things, but we're not going to talk about it. I think it was a watershed moment in 20 years ago when NOVA produced Newton's Dark Secrets. Newton, the first modern scientist and the last of the ancient magicians. It really brought to the public mind the other side of Isaac Newton. Since then, The Newton Project at Oxford has digitized more than 95% of all of Newton's written work. The goal is 100%, but I don't think we'll ever reach 100% because it's difficult to find some manuscripts. But we have this information now of what Newton wrote on everything else. And from this, it really turns out the best way to understand Isaac Newton is that he's first and foremost a theologian. Everything else is based upon his theology. He studied physics because he wanted to understand how God created the world. He studied mathematics because he saw mathematics as the language God used to create the world. He studied alchemy, one of those things we don't talk about today, because he wanted to see how God is sustaining the world. If he understands the alchemy, he understands how creation is continuing creation, and God sustaining the world. And he studied biblical prophecy because he wanted to see how God interacts with humanity. Everything is based upon his theology, and so everything makes sense to think of Newton as first and foremost a theologian, not first and foremost a scientist. The science comes out of his theology. Now, in his theology, Newton was what we call theologically a voluntarist. He believed that the business of true philosophy, science, is to derive the nature of things from causes truly existent, and to inquire after those laws on which the great creator actually chose to found this most beautiful frame of the world, not those by which he might have done the same had he so pleased. So this means that God freely chose to complete the world. Once he made that decision, he had freedom in how to do it. And so therefore, this is where the word empirical comes from, empirical science. We're not looking at how God might have created the world, hey, so chosen. We're looking at how God actually chose to do so. So Newton wrote about a lot of things besides his science. He wrote a lot on biblical prophecy. And although most of Newton's writings were kept in a trunk for 200 years until they were finally sold at auction by Sotheby's in 1936, and that's when, after 200 years, some of the other manuscripts came to light. Two books were published shortly after Newton's death, The Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms and Observations on the Prophecies of Daniel and the Apocalypse. These two books together form the foundation of what theologians call the historicist interpretation of biblical prophecy. And so the historicist interpretation is used by many biblical scholars today. The idea that Daniel is the interpretive key for all the biblical prophecy came from Newton. The dates of when things happen, so you can get the date at which Christ was predicted to come, this is all in the chronology of the ancient kingdoms that Newton put together. So Newton was just as thorough and complete in his analysis of biblical prophecy as he was in his physics and mathematics, and had a tremendous impact upon many of the prophetic movements that have arisen since then. The third person I want to talk about is James Clerk Maxwell. For people who are not a physicist, this is probably the most important physicist that you've never heard of. He's definitely the most important physicist of the 19th century. His work, The Dynamical Theory of the Electromagnetic Field, revolutionized the field of physics, where he thought of electricity and magnetism as relational entities. A change in magnetic field generates electricity, a change in electrical field generates magnetism. Albert Einstein really valued this in Maxwell. In fact, without Maxwell's ground-laying work, there would not have been Einsteinian relativity. To quote Einstein, before Maxwell, people thought of physical reality as material points. After Maxwell, they thought of physical reality as represented by continuous fields, not mechanically explicable. This change in the conception of reality is the most profound and the most fruitful that physics has experienced since Newton. So Maxwell completely threw out Newtonian mechanical view of the universe to a relational view of the universe. Well, how did he do this? Well, the Scottish theologian James Clerk Maxwell has written extensively about this, and he credits Maxwell's Trinitarian theology, a relational Trinitarian theology, as being foundational to his establishment of his physics theories. To quote Torrance, his Christian faith provided Clerk Maxwell with certain analogical truths, root ideas and fundamental conceptions, for which natural science could not account, but which guided him in the scientific task of awaiting thought and objective realities. It was not that Clerk Maxwell imported theological conceptions as such into his science, but with a slant of his deeply Christian mind informed by faith that exercised a guiding role in the choice and formation of his leading scientific concepts. So his Christian understanding of God led him to put forth fundamentally new ideas that transform the basic structure of natural science. That is to say, it was Maxwell's theological convictions that played a heuristic and effective role in the development of his science. So in each of these three individuals, their theology is what provided the worldview, which provided the ideas that allowed them to do revolutionary science, allowed them to completely change the paradigms in front of them to something completely new and unexpected. So today, going into the 21st century, when we look at these three fundamental principles, we see that they are just as valid today. Principle number one, the universe exists and has a beginning. Over the past 100 years, we've discovered that the physical laws were extremely finely tuned to enable the existence of life within it. And so I love to tell the story of Fred Hoyle, who was a skeptic, who was a rather poor atheist, because he, after discovering the carbon resonance, said that somebody has monkeyed with the physics. And so he gets that. The universe is orderly and follows mathematical laws. Eugene Wigner, his 1960 paper, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences, he talks about the miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. In this short paper, Wigner uses the word miracle 12 times to describe how incredible it is that mathematics works, both in the sense that the universe follows mathematical laws and the human mind is capable of understanding the mathematics. And the third principle, that we are capable of understanding the world. Philosopher Alvin Plantinga at Notre Dame and others have really looked at the idea of if you look at a naturalistic explanation of human origins, that is incapable of providing valid confidence in the ability of human reasoning to understand the universe. This is what Plantinga means by there being a superficial concord, but a deep conflict between science and naturalism. That is, our mental abilities evolved through purely naturalistic processes. There's no reliability that these mental capacities would make any truth statements about the nature of reality. For Christians, however, this warrant of reliability comes directly from the doctrine of creation. So whether a scientist believes in God or not, these three fundamental principles remain necessary assumptions in order to do science. The difference between the Christian and the atheist is the Christian knows where these fundamental principles come from. So I want to end just with two stanzas from James Clerk Maxwell's Student's Evening Hymn. Maxwell not only was a brilliant physicist, he was a great poet. Thou that fill'st our waiting eyes with the food of contemplation, setting in thy darkened skies signs of infinite creation, grant to nightly meditation what the toilsome day denies, teach me in this earthly station heavenly truth to realize. Teach me so thy works to read that my faith, new strength accruing, may from world to world proceed, wisdom's fruitful search pursuing. Tell thy truth, my mind imbuing, I proclaim the eternal creed, oft the glorious theme renewing, our God, our Lord, is God indeed. Thank you. Thank you.
Gary. We have about 5 minutes for questions. As a reminder, questions often start with a word like who, what, when, where, why, and end with a voice going on the end.
I don't know how to do that. Thank you for your presentation, very helpful. When I think of the relationship that theology can have to the natural sciences as providing something of a framework like you're arguing for, and then when we look at historical figures like Kepler, Newton, and Maxwell, who I've not heard of before, so thank you for that, and especially that poem. Given Newton's, you know, Trinitarian heresy, he was likely some sort of Neo-Arian or deist or Socinian or something, so he's a heretic when it comes to Trinity. Philosophically, he's something of an anomalous, which I think is problematic too. How does that factor into our evaluations of somebody like Newton when we would say as Christians, look, this science can only happen in a Christian framework, look at somebody like Newton, but then Newton denies something fundamental to the order that Christianity provides to the sciences, which would be something like the Trinity. So like, how do we evaluate those and sort of like be honest and recognize the problems and then like evaluate the usefulness going forward?
So I would say that worldviews are important for advancement in science. It doesn't have to be a Christian worldview. Definitely advances in quantum mechanics have come about through people that are very steeped in Eastern religions. And there's some compatibility to how they develop that. So it's not that you have to have the correct worldview in order to advance science. However, my presumption would be that the better your theology is, the more that will conform to the created reality, and therefore that will be more productive and more fruitful. Newton obviously had some theological errors. I probably would disagree on how much theological errors he had, because I would say there's probably nobody in the room that would not reject the Trinitarian theory that he rejected, because he was very much rejecting what we would consider to be tritheism now. He did not have the relational perspective.
He didn't affirm the deity of the Son, though, I don't think, did he?
He affirmed the Son.
The full deity.
But as far as that, my understanding is that he was very much protective of the sovereignty of God. He did not want to admit anything that would go against the sovereignty of God. But that takes a lot more study than I have done as to what those details are. But certainly, he was a very, very strong Christian with some heterodox beliefs, I'd say, perhaps heretical beliefs. But he had a lot of Christianity very solid.
Ted Davies? Darren.
Thank you for that presentation. Quick question. So would you propose that scientific knowledge is a species of theology?
Natural philosophy, I mean, obviously the early scientists would have totally agreed with you on that. Yes, there's a strong relationship. And Torrance, I really appreciate reading Torrance. Torrance talks about a theological science. Others talk about scientific theology as different ways, but he talked about theological science. So there's some relationship there between ultimate reality. For a theologian, studying ultimate reality is understanding God. For a scientist, ultimate reality is studying the creation. Well, there's a relationship between the creation and the creator. And I think that if we can maintain that relationship, then the relationship between science and theology should remain strong as well because of that.
We have time for one more. Okay, I just thank you for the interesting book title recommendations. One of them, you were mentioning Newton, and they referred to him as an ancient magician. What can you expand on? What did they mean when they were referring to that?
So that was referring back to his alchemy. So he did a lot of alchemical work. And there's a famous 18th century woodcutting that shows a picture of Newton's dog kicking over a lantern and all of his work for the previous 2 years going up in flames. It's entirely apocryphal. And it's a story that was, I think, manufactured by some of Newton's friends to explain why he had a two-year period that he had no data whatsoever from. But that was time that he was doing alchemy. And it was a total failure, total collapse. And he went to a deep depression when his alchemical experiments failed. But that's what they were talking about.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Yes.